Accession number 23812, Reel 9.
Mr. Doyle, Reel 9. Now, what happened when you got to Salita Airfield?
Well, Salita Aerodrome, we adopted some defensive positions as best as we could, hurriedly digging trenches, etc., etc. But evidently the Japs were in the surrounding area around the aerodrome, and we took up these defensive positions, and all the time we were receiving orders as
time,
to what to do and where to go. And we were then told once again to take up a retreat through the airfield, and there was a small village there, of which the Japs were at one end of this this village, and they had installed machine guns looking right down this road. So as we retreated, so we had to cross this roadway with the Japs firing their machine guns down the road at us. And I can well recall that we held our breath. Immediately the machine gun stopped. We had to take life in our hands and rush across the roadway to the other side, where the where there were some buildings. And some of our chaps unfortunately did get hit during these manoeuvres. Food by then had become almost non-existent. All that we had were some biscuits, some emergency rations, which comprised of these odd biscuits, a sort of little block of chocolate, etc. I broke into a dwelling there, and I found that there were large cases of carnation condensed milk. I can remember the name only too well, and I stuck my baylet into the tin and drank from these tins of milk, which made us terribly thirsty. I still had some water left in my water bottle. I'll relate to myself personally now. I was able to partake of that that little bit of water, which I knew that I had to reserve as much as I could, because there was nothing forthcoming in that direction, either food or water by then. The whole thing became chaotic. So we managed to get to the other side of the aerodrome, and we took up defences, and we fired over where we thought with our rifles, etc., etc., where we thought the Japanese existed.
So you retreated from one side of the airfield to the
air to the other. Yes, it was of ground which was foreign to us. We had no idea of the ground. It was quite alien ground as far as we were concerned, and there we found ourselves eventually near a Chinese cemetery, and we took up positions behind these sort of marble structures and that sort of thing, and managed to fire at the Japs as we saw the Japs coming along. Evidently the main Jap invasion was further away from us, as I've said, where these Aussies were. So these were pockets, I assume, of the Japanese who were there. This continued for some time, and from there we're still retreating from whence or where, I've no idea, or where we were going. And once again, I found myself with other chaps where the planters' houses were. And where the planters' houses were swimming pools. And so from the swimming pools, we thought it a good idea to refill our water bottles. But when we got there, we found that on top of the surface of the swimming pool was smothered in the oil, of which I've already stated that all the oil wells and that, and a pall of smoke over Singapore, it was a horrific sight, it must have been, to see the island of Singapore covered in this thick oil smoke. But nevertheless, it was either drinking this or nothing, so we managed to scoop away with our palm of our hands the oil and get as much of the fresh water as we could from there. From there, we eventually took up positions once again and tried to hurriedly form defensive positions. Time alone had departed from us, so we couldn't tell one day from another. I couldn't tell you how long we were there. That has now departed from my memory. But what I can say is that we were still engaging the Japanese at that particular time when it came through that a message came through via our officers that Singapore had fallen and had capitulated. We knew nothing about this at all because quite obviously it was a few miles away from us where this capitulation took place with Percival and the senior officers, but I think it's well known in history exactly where it took place.
And how did you feel when you heard
that Singapore had fallen, it was with disbelief. We just could not believe that Singapore had fallen like that. But later, as we learned from what had actually happened, was it was not necessarily because of the forces, our own forces, not being able to hold the Japanese. It was that on the causeway there existed the water supply to Singapore and to Singapore town itself, or Singapore City, and the people there, all the water had been cut off, the civilians were being bombed from their premises. There was chaos in Singapore itself. There was a tremendous population there of, I suppose, millions, I don't know, of people, and therefore the whole thing had got so chaotic. That I believe that was one of the reasons, or perhaps the main reason, why Singapore fell. Not because of the military personnel of the day. We were quite ready to fight and continue to fight, which was the case when we were told that Singapore had fallen. So it was quite a shock to us. And we were completely bewildered as to what was going to happen to us. Our officers then explained that they would do their best in that period of time at which further instructions would be issued. We were to remain at our positions, and food and the like would be brought to us as best as one could in the circumstances. So we were there for quite a number of days before anything actually took place.
See any Japanese?
No, we never saw any Japanese at that particular time where we were. I think that probably the Japanese soldiers had been called to wherever their military points were to be distributed amongst the island, and we were left entirely to our own devices.
So you hadn't disarmed, you were just in your defence.
We were not disarmed anyway whatsoever at that particular time. No. We were told to ceasefire existed, and ceasefire, of course,
Sir, can we say some more about the preliminaries to
all those things? What happened afterwards? were vague to me because we were there for several days just resting and that sort of thing. And I must say that we slept many long hours because, as I've already stated, we were completely exhausted troops.
We were, of course, for...
Eventually,
about a year
we
before
were all given instructions to meet a certain area in Singapore.
And this
was by our own officers who were receiving instructions, I assume, from the British headquarters in Singapore. So we all arrived in a mess and had to sit. This was in a part of Singapore, a big open space. I can't tell you exactly where because, to be honest, I was not really conversant with the island of Singapore. It was Singapore Island and Singapore town as far as we were concerned. So peace then reigned over Singapore. All the noise of artillery fire, etc., etc., had ceased. It became relatively peaceful. We were left to our own devices and to the instructions of our own officers.
What happened when you got to this role, David?
When we got to there, we were told all to sit down, and there we were, all the forces, British forces, were sitting in one mess, open space.
And basically,
we were then told at that particular juncture that we would be informed as exactly what was going to happen to us, where we were going to, etc., etc. We found that our unit were to go to Changi, not to Changi prison, but to Changi barracks. At the other side of the island, which we were told that we were to march there. So we became a motley crowd then, and we had to disarm. We were all disarmed.
Before the march?
Before the march, we were all disarmed, yes.
Value for effort.
We had to lay down our arms.
Have you seen the Japanese yet?
Yes, the Japanese were all there in force. The Japanese high command, I suppose, were there. And when we recognise the Japanese average soldier, he was dressed in these baggy trousers. He had on his feet what looked to us at that time looked like animal feet. They were rubber shoes, and they were divided. So apparently the big toe went into one side, and the toes went into the other. Evidently these were a type of shoes that served a useful purpose in the jungle because they could shin up trees like monkeys, you know, and that sort of thing. Whereas we still had our big army boots, which were cumbersome by comparison. That's how they were fitted out, but that was an ideal attire for jungle warfare. Would you like me to...
How did they treat you
at that particular time? We had no idea of the mentality of the Japanese. We were simply left to our own officers under their instructions, which obviously came from the Japanese via our own high command. And we were told that we were, as I've just said, to go to the other end of the island, wherever that might be, to Changi, it was a long march. We marched along quite proudly. We were in no way did we look a disorganised unit as such. I think we tried to put a brave face on it by marching in a proper manner, as indeed we were doing exactly the same as if we were in England on the march to Shaggy. On the way, as we rested at various points, some of the natives of the little villages would come out, and they would give us little cups of tea, a few little delicacies and that sort of thing. Basically, they were Chinese. I think they were because we began, by that time we began to distinguish between Chinese, Malays, etc., etc. And they were also little places which appeared to be Christian dwellings, a little chapel. And that where these people would come out, obviously Christians, and give us these little delicacies on the way to Changi Barracks.
So what happened when you got to
Changi Barracks? Well, Changi Barracks was, I suppose, during the occupation of the British, quite a place. They were extensive barracks. They had steel bedding and that sort of thing in it, and mattresses. The whole barracks had a certain amount of appeal as being a place of cleanliness and the like. But we were to find out, as we were housed in these various barracks and sorted out into our different units, that food, most unfortunately, food was pretty non-existent. And so we found out exactly where and how starvation was to eventually affect us physically and possibly mentally.
What food did they give you?
The food that they gave us there, my first experience, was obviously rice. Now, the rice that they gave us at that particular time was ghastly. They had somehow got from, though I suppose, that their stocks in Singapore, seed rice, which had been dusted with sulphur. I think it was sulphur, because it was, when it was boiled up, it was yellowish green, and it tasted of rotten eggs, and it was pretty ghastly. But it was either to eat that, or not to eat, and to just simply to die.
So you just got the one portion of rice a day?
Very much.
By that time, as I've just said, initially, this is what we existed on, this ghastly rice. As time went on, as time went on that particular time, they managed to set up these kitchens. I never did go into the kitchen, so I knew very little about it. The barrack area is quite extensive, by the way. And the cooks there managed to contrive all sorts of things which they were at that particular time in England of, but they managed, because rice being a staple diet, they managed to do all sorts of wonderful things with just rice alone, and they would make little cakes and that sort of thing. There would be an allocation of a certain amount of sugar which they would add to it. We also had little pieces of meat now and again, and this and green stuff, foreign to me, I must say, what exactly what they were, but whatever they were, we ate. We never bothered what they consisted of. It's a question of survival as far as food was concerned. The fact that we were left to our own devices in those barracks for some considerable time. We were completely under instructions from our own officers, etc., etc. I never saw a Japanese at all for some period of time. We simply left there.
How overcrowded were your rooms?
We were reasonably housed, I suppose. The beds and that sort of thing were quite together, but there were quite extensive barracks there, so there was a reasonable amount of room, and that didn't cause us in that respect any real discomfort. The main thing was food. That was the thing. The whole of our minds centred on food, because the rations what we were on were such that they began to gradually take effect on people. They began to take effect on people in as much as beriberi suddenly appeared on the scene.
Beriberi
was caused through the lack of vitamin B. That was one of the main vitamins, and this is how it affected people. There was wet beriberi and a dry beriberi. Now, the wet beriberi affected you in your legs and body. Your legs began to swell. They began to come full of water. And you developed what we call elephant-type legs. Your legs became swollen to the extent right down to your feet. This, I think, created problems with one's heart. And this developed into what was called heart beriberi. There was also dry beriberi. Now, dry beriberi was a sensation of which you were never without. And we developed on our scrotum, they become red and swollen. And so therefore one used to walk with your penis tied up with a piece of string around your belly so it didn't touch your scrotum, and because it was so tender and sore. And this was one of the effects. The men, as I've said during my narration, they nicknamed everything. They were soon called and known throughout the prison of war life as Chaggy Balls. This humour was one of the things which even in the straits that we were in, desperate straits that we were in,
did dry beriberi have any other effects, or was it just on the scrotum?
It had effect basically on the scrotum, but it did also affect your feet. You know, your feet became terribly irritated and that. Also, one's eyesight became affected. Instead of having a clear sight, it would become blurred somewhat. Many of the chaps, despite the fact that they were starving, somehow or other, to eat rice they just could not. And there were some chaps, some real big chaps that we knew in our army life, who succumbed to life by not being able to eat rice. Somehow they couldn't eat it. It was revolting to them. I don't know. I think that was in the minority, but certainly that did happen. But
well, was anything done for them?
Gradually, the rations improved somewhat. When I say improved, we began to get a little bit extra meat, fish and green foods, and the thing which the rice lacked evidently was the exterior skin of rice, and if that was taken away, they became those skins became known as rice polishings, and being so, they were rich in vitamin B. And so, therefore, we were issued with rice polishings. That was very bitter to take, but you spread it on your rice. Some of the rice parlations were full of maggots and weevils, but nevertheless, if there happened to be some in after you'd sorted them out, well, that was all good protein, so we had to close our eyes and eat that. So that was our life.
What would a typical day be like? I mean, how would you spend a day at Changi?
So that was our life at the boat, other than the fact that at night time we had to find some ways of occupying ourselves. This was brought about by the officers realising that they had to do something to keep the men occupied, because we were doing precisely nothing. So we formed little concert parties. We would have chaps who were fairly conversant in a particular subject would come, and at night time we would sit down and they would talk and tell us about and let us know exactly what their knowledge was on these different aspects of life. This was a fairly good state, and as I say, we were completely free of the Japs on seeing them. That's the way life became. Other than that, you were lying about on your beds during the daytime. You went to visit other people that you knew in other blocks and talk to them, and basically, of course, it was about food or home.
Can you just describe your concert party stuff a bit more?
The concert parties were made up of some chaps who were quite gifted. Some even still had musical instruments, and there were little orchestras which were formed. And I can remember some of the orchestras striking up with some of Strauss's music, which brought back many memories to people. On the improvised stages that we made up with any boxes and pieces of wood and that sort of thing, then we had
the invasion.
I think you wanted to make one or two additions,
and
or
that
amendments
which we found and converted them into curtains in front of the stage, and then different people would come out and do their little party pieces, so to speak. They were singers. There were people who they formed little sketches. Some dressed up as females as best as they could, which brought a lot of cat calls and that sort of thing from the. From the prison that generally made up
and
helped the
morale.
Not myself. No, I didn't do anything at that time.
You were a singer?
No, I wasn't. I wasn't a singer at that time. That I was not a singer until after the war. I wasn't. But I could, as I said, I did play the violin, but I had no violin to play, so quite obviously I couldn't join in. But
you said humour was very important. Can you talk a bit about the sort of humour and why it was important? What about that?
Well, humour with as I went through my prison of war life, and I found that the British people, as opposed to other people like the Dutch, who we eventually linked up with, which I will tell you about later. They just seemed devoid of humour. English humour was telling humorous jokes and yarns, and that some of them clean and some not so clean. They were probably even to the extent of playing a prank or something on somebody, you know, that sort of thing. That was the English makeup. Why it existed in certain people and nationalities, I just do not know, but that did, and we are, by that sort of humour, we were always able to keep up our morale. I don't know why it was, but the British throughout my prison war life could keep up a high morale. We even sang songs to which were insult to the Japanese, which they didn't know. They quite enjoyed hearing us sing, despite the fact that we were singing something detrimental to the Japanese, which probably led to shock a lot of us if they knew what it was about. But that was the type of thing, difficult to explain, but that is part of the makeup in the general sense of the British serviceman.